Hey, 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 Talking Shizzle listeners. You know, it's always been important for me to align our business with other companies and individuals who share our values, especially those who share a deep commitment to serving nonprofits and social impact. So for that reason, I'm super excited to announce our very first season two sponsor, Kela. Kela is a fundraising and donor management CRM that is built specifically for nonprofits by nonprofit professionals. These folks really get it. Their mission is to empower nonprofits to deepen relationships, retain donors, and raise more for their cause. Now, several of our clients and partners use Kela and have continued to be impressed by just how easy Kela is to use, how affordable it is, and most importantly, the results they see using the platform. The Kela team is also phenomenal to work with. They are super friendly guys, and they have a continuous commitment to equity and inclusion. Now, go check them out. We got a special offer for you. As season two sponsor of the Talking Shizzle podcast, Kela is offering our listeners and community 40% off their first year subscription to Kela. 40%, you guys. That is a lot of shizzle. Think about all the other shizzle you can get done by saving that money on your nonprofit CRM. Plus, if you have under 250 records, you can get access to the Kela Starter Program for free. So if you are interested in learning more and booking a demo, go to kela.co/partners/creative-shizzle. That is kela.co/partners/creative-shizzle. Hey, hey, all you lovely people out there. You've got a lot going on in your day with big dreams and big goals for your world. Are you ready to talk some shizzle and learn some shizzle from leading entrepreneurs, changemakers, coaches, and overall interesting people who like to shake things up? I'm your host, Taylor Shanklin, CEO and founder of Creative Shizzle, and I am stoked to bring you a fresh episode of Talking Shizzle today. This show is all about helping you think differently so that you can grow. Talking Shizzle is brought to you by our team at Creative Shizzle, where we help businesses, entrepreneurs, and social good innovators make amazing marketing shizzle happen. Check us out on the web at creativeshizzle.com. Now, let's talk some shizzle. All right, what's up, folks? It is January 3rd. This is our first recording of Talking Shizzle for the new year. Super pumped to be here today with Brian Shimeski. I think I got that right.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's good to have you here. You are the founder and CEO of a cool company named Zurb. By the way, go to zurb.com, check out their website. It's super cool, super fun. So, Brian, thanks for coming on and talking some shizzle with us today. We're going to be talking about progressive design. But before we get into it, I want to hear a little bit about your background, who you are, why you started Zurb, and what you are zurbing around doing these days.
What I'm zurbing around doing. So, graduated in 1997 and really excited about technology and learning about it. Almost failed my CS class and didn't really understand or want to do any kind of coding. And what do? A year later, I created a business that helps people figure out how to make their coding useful. So 98, so we'll be 25 years and started the business with the intent of helping people make their digital creations with the idea that most of those creations we were working on at the time were products. They were things that people used and needed to function and have utility and were not magazine sort of layouts. So the complexities of working with lots of people to produce something just got me really excited. And I realized the convergence of really understanding people and sort of needs and what they wanted from the product, what the customers wanted from the product, what the management wanted from the product alongside the people making it. You know, the engineers, the designers, the marketers who had to sort of position this thing. And so I found that extremely fascinating. I realized it wasn't as rational as I thought it was. Like it's not an engineering problem. It's very much about understanding the edges of problems and being able to work with people. And so that's what we've been doing for 25 years and had the fortunate opportunity to work on some of the coolest products around, from Netflix, Hulu, basically every major company in Silicon Valley, except sans Google. Never worked with Google.
Very cool. So have you had your hand in any of the like design behind Netflix, like choosing what we want to watch, anything like that?
We actually did the first version of Just for Kids. So when that launched, we had learned a bunch of things about how kids did video online. And that a lot of that work actually migrated and pushed into the main Netflix. So I don't know if you remember when it first came out, all this metadata, and it was like sort of like a library with lots of information. And the experience you have now on the TV is much more like browsing windows of thumbnails and fun things. And so what we learned, kids just want to watch what they were watching before and where they left off. And so there was like a progress bar of what they'd seen and watched and the latest thumbnail of what episode they were on. And brands, like kids understood brands, like they understood and identified with characters and used that sort of as a reference to help them find what they're looking for. So you'll see a lot of that sort of simple pattern now in most of the apps where, you know, you're it's very visual medium and not so much like a library. Much more like the original Blockbuster, where you go in, you walk the aisles and you saw the cover art and you're like, oh, I want this one, right? And you'd hold on to the box until you found the next box and you were kind of like, okay, which one are we watching? So that experience early on was lost, you know, and sort of the browsing experience. And so trying to simplify that. So that'd be an example of some of the work we had done and started off with. So, and that it's been around a while, but, yeah, stuff like that is exciting to us to try and figure out how do you solve those types of problems.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I was actually just having a conversation with a friend a few days ago about like, remember when we went to Blockbuster on Friday night and it kind of like set up our whole weekend, you know? And then like my first early memories of Netflix are in college getting the DVDs delivered to my apartment. And then, you know, forgetting to put them back in the mail. And then, you know, like, oh, I still have this one. Oops, you know.
But it didn't feel as bad because somehow you weren't being charged for that CD. It was more like, I'm not seizing as much opportunity to watch more, but you didn't feel as bad. More like the gym membership. Whereas Blockbuster, you'd go in with your tail between your legs and try to convince them that the 2 days, like somehow there was a problem here. Like your date is wrong, or you know, I didn't. Your store was closed, or someone shut the door early. Or
Blockbuster had more power; they would revoke your card.
It was a disappointing experience usually, and I never got it on in time. I don't know. I was just never like that type of person that was like trying to figure out how to get it in on time. So,
yeah. I know, never did. And always fighting those late fees. Yeah, last night I took my daughter to drop off a book at the public library. And she was like, but Mom, the library's closed. I was like, well, there should be a book drop. And she was like, what's a book drop? I was like, well, after hours, you drop the book and a thing and it goes into the building.
Okay. I know people want to hear about our experience, but we're really aging ourselves here.
Yeah, we really are. Well, all right, first failure of the year, not staying on topic for our first Talking Shizzle podcast of the year, but that actually takes us into failures. I want to hear a little bit about some of your failures and something that you've learned maybe from let's just talk about a large failure, okay? You have worked with a ton of very large brands in Silicon Valley. You must have had little failures along the way.
Tons of failures
along the way. Like, what's one you're comfortable talking about today, and what you learned from it?
Well, I can talk about some of the more funny ones. Those are always interesting. So, like we were talking about a little bit before, every failure list is sort of like I can pick basically everything on the list and say, "Oh yeah, I've experienced that." At this stage, I don't laugh at really anything. So when I first started back in maybe one of the first projects I had worked on in 2000. I had been invited to work on this new public company that really didn't know much about websites, and websites were sort of this thing you just kind of did and you had your sort of uncle or your cousin work on it. And this is a public company. But so I was invited to a meeting that no one told me when the meeting was, and they all showed up and the executive team did the meeting and said, "Where are you?" And so I had to sprint over there 15 minutes late. And this was a newly pressed couple billionaires in the room. And so I was sprinting in, and we were expected to try and come up with ideas on the website. So I was leading a brainstorm in which my task was to help everyone kind of figure out what the website should be about. So I started the brainstorm and I asked everyone at the table, okay, do people have some ideas of what they want in this website? I'm at the whiteboard, and the billionaire one is at my right, and the billionaire is at the head of the table, way at this long table. I was like, okay, what do we got? And so the first person that starts talking is the salesperson talking about why he's had a bad quarter and why why the sales distribution. I'm like, okay, where do I go with this? How do I spin this person? I'm like in my 20s. I'm like, this has nothing to do with the website. How do I refocus this? And then the HR person, who I had kind of grown a little bit of rapport with in this process, started speaking and talking about what did she need in the talent side. But she was cut off by someone else at the table. And I kid you not, within, I would say, about 90 seconds, the billionaire said, "I think we're done here." So I was sitting at the head of the table, or I was standing at the head of the table with a whiteboard with a marker. I'm like, okay, what do I do now? I think we're done here. So I'm like, all right, do I take a seat? Do I walk out the room? Do I like try to figure out like how to transition it into a conversation? So I learned very early on that the web is a very odd medium, and that, you know, you have to have people prepared. You have to know what you're trying to talk about. You have to sort of understand what their problems are. You have to, like, there's so much prep work and understanding of the problems that going into a meeting with a bunch of people and just expecting that they're going to have ideas is just unrealistic. And that was one of my first big experiences learning that, yeah, preparation is really important, especially when you have two billionaires in the room.
Yeah, we're done here.
We're done. And it rings true to this day. I'm like, okay, I hear those words all the time. I think we're done. I think we're done here, right? With the "I think" was I'm speaking. We are done here. Yeah, that humbling experience. And if you don't have a whole lot of business experience, even if you did have business experience, just standing there at the front of a table, like trying to figure out what to do, is learned a lot from that.
No, that's absolutely a lesson we can all learn. And I remember also being earlier on in my career and being in some of those like boardrooms that I didn't feel like I was really ready to be in, and just fumbling around like, And then the head honcho person does say something. Okay. Yep. Get on it. So yeah, that's it.
Well, maybe, I mean, the way you can look at it is maybe he saved me, right?
Right, exactly. Yes, wait, what did you end up doing? Did you just leave?
No, I took a seat at the table and was a good listener.
Okay, good idea.
Took lots of notes on a notepad and stayed focused on listening to what people said.
Very good. Good idea. Well, Will's going to come up with a good dad joke about we're done here by the end of this episode. Yeah. Right, Will?
I'm still in 22. I remember like it was yesterday, but I'm on to dad jokes in 2023.
Well, the dad joke part of that is, I think we're done here. That's the part that resonates the most, because it was like, do we want to stop? And it was more of an authoritative, like, we're stopping. And so I realized this paradox of like trying to be inclusive at the same time getting your way. So yeah, learn from that one.
Let's get into progressive design. Talk to us a little bit more about what this is. I mean, we talked about your, you know, work with Netflix in that example, but like, what are some other kind of like starting points, things to know about what progressive design even is?
Progressive design is, you know, every creative agency is going to have their own developed process, right? That, you know, you learn to work in a way that aligns your operation with, you know, someone trying to get something done. What I learned early in the process of again, like the billionaire meeting, is that building and making things online is equal parts irrational and rational. The irrational parts are extremely difficult to navigate in a medium that is like sort of unforgiving. It works or it doesn't work. And so trying to reconcile these two worlds requires helping people see broader visions along a continuum. Just saying it's going to be this thing, most people aren't willing to accept it or want all that change or know how to accept that change or even know how to talk to other people about this thing that was just made up, right? And so progressive design aims to make smaller incremental gains through conversations around moving people towards a bigger vision. And so what I realized is you can't just have this vision, put it out there and expect people to be super motivated and psyched to do it, especially when they've asked for your help and they've struggled through a problem and you're like, oh, it's this thing right here. And they're like, what? So progressive design aims to make structured debate and conversation around creative decisions and being able to move someone and a group of people to a better place. And so when you get that momentum and you're able to get a ball rolling and people are more willing to accept sort of the possibilities of what something could be, then you get them in a posture that is more accepting and willing to sort of understand, say, why an idea might be valid or why it could potentially be a good solution.
Now, that seems to me like a theory that could be applied to a lot of things. I mean, product development and design in your realm, but like in our realm, I'm even thinking, I'm like, well, that's what we do all the time was showing someone their new brand. Like, this is where you're going to go and this is what it looks like. And they're like, I don't know about that. And I'm like, just trust us, you know? But like, how do you walk people through that process? And that's really like, again, just so applicable in a lot of industries, a lot of verticals, a lot of different things.
So much psychology is involved in it because most people have to operate, especially in a larger business, from a fear, not necessarily in their day to day, but when it comes to creative things that don't exist. So that once it gets outside of an operational sort of plan, it starts to become very like frightening. Right. Even if your job is creative director, trying to work within a group of people in which you've gotten really comfortable with their choices and their decisions, trying to push people outside of that can be really difficult. And there is, like you said, trust. And so I found that I start most work that I do with anyone that's making something, accepting the fact that there is no trust. When we talk about trust, like creative trust, like where are you taking me? And that trust needs to be earned through interacting and conversing and trying to figure out how you build that confidence towards the place that you feel is going to help them. And they need to be a co-partner in that, right? They can't, I mean, you can stylize something and you can kind of put it on them and say, this is who you are. But ultimately that typically doesn't create the best creative results because they need to invest some of themselves into whatever it is to really have it have legs and last and be able to be a part of their business. So I find that is the most exciting part of the creative process is getting people into postures that are exciting to them and they get excited to want to talk to you about those new possibilities. I found that it typically takes about 2 weeks for that sort of intense process to unfold. But oftentimes it takes 6 months for them to really want to be in a place where they can accept something that's a big idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that too. It kind of depends on the person or the organization or company or team and kind of what you're dealing with there.
So progressive design has like all these methods and ideas around building that trust and how you move people through a continuum of a creative process.
And it being deeply psychological is kind of where my mind went too. Like even going back when you were talking about the Netflix experience and all of the experiences that we have in these products that we interact with every day, so much of them is rooted in like, how do humans behave? So you mentioned trust. What are some other principles of psychology that you take into your work?
Oh, it's, I mean, there's all kinds of methods and ways of thinking about this, but think about it like this. I tell my team, if you want me to do something and I feel like it's pretty good, then I want to agree with you. I don't by nature want to disagree with you per se. I might be more negative in my sort of understanding of the idea. That's just based in being a human. We tend to like not like change, but if you have a good idea and you structure it for me to understand what that idea is, then I'm more willing to accept leaning into it. So an example, one part of progressive design is we say it's threes. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to show you, and I'm going to tell you what I just showed you. So something as simple as that, people need repetition. They need to understand, sort of like hear it, they have to see it, and then they have to have confidence in sort of you telling me what I just saw. Their window or their movie is a little different than yours. And so when you reframe it and continue to tell them what they just saw, then they can see it maybe from a different lens. And so if it's, say, maybe like you're doing a whole rebrand, you're not trying to do all the colors and logos and everything about that. You might be only focusing on a few points of it, like color, like what is the color trying to invoke and speaking to the color, because looking at the logo and the color is just way too much, like way too many things to try and process to understand. So progressive design aims to sort of build on top of those decisions and those understandings to get, say, a full brand that gets people excited, and making those incremental sort of agreements where people can feel comfortable that they reach sort of a plateau of understanding and willingness to accept an idea helps to kind of move them into the next sort of more difficult, say, larger idea that would require more trust and more understanding, like the logo mark itself, right? Where, you know, it sort of is the representation of their business or who they are. So that would be one thing in progressive design. Threes are a big thing. You know, repeating things are often important. I've also found that when people give feedback, they're more complicit to where they're going. So even if they disagree, you need to have people feel good about providing feedback. Feedback's sort of like the icky word and sounds less exciting. But if you want to bring people on a creative process, you need to have them confident enough to give feedback, even if it's horrible feedback, because then you can shape that feedback in a way that they can rationalize in their head. And creative ideas are often just, they're made up. There's no one perfect answer. So you're really trying to get alignment and agreement of what that creative vision can be with that person. And when you add two people and three people and four people, these processes become more important because you need them giving feedback with each other and being able to buy in to where they want to go.
Well, everything we're all doing is all made up all the time, right? And then you get to a point where at some point, something that someone made up works. And then you get to a point of collecting information and data on that and figuring out, well, this is what works. So we're going to build on that a little bit. So I imagine, like, when I go to your website, it says data and design and data, like that's your kind of headline. I imagine a lot of what you're doing now is then helping to understand with data what's actually working on a product level or user experience level. Is that right?
It's still all made up. The data can't tell you. Data can't tell you what to do. Like it's not going to tell you what to do. Like people read data and they're informed and they can figure out, like, but data doesn't tell you what to do. And so, you know, where we've really been focused with progressive design and how to utilize it is in audience feedback. So think about it like when you give that book report presentation in second grade and you're like scared as could be and you're up there talking about this thing and you're worried about Joey over there looking at you and making fun of you and Cindy over there like stealing your ideas and you're up there just trying to talk. What's frightening about that is that unknown of that sea of people over there, right? They're like, they're going to judge me. I don't know what's going on. And so what we've developed is audiences that give you the perspective of all that people in that classroom, like giving you that feedback so that you can learn and figure out how they're thinking about what you've presented. The cool thing about it is if you keep doing that, you start to learn that, oh, audiences are really all over the place. They don't all think you're the worst speaker. They don't think you're all the worst book picker, or they don't think you're all the worst poster maker, right? They all have different ideas of what they're seeing. And so when you build creative things, the creator tends to think that there's this singular vision that people are going to like pick apart. And oftentimes it's not like that. And so when you have audience feedback that you can see these unique perspectives from groups of people that may say like buy your product or may be interested in your book or whatever, you get a very refined way of continuing to evolve those ideas with confidence. You still have to work with informed, experienced people around you because, again, data isn't going to tell you how to design things, but it does help you understand when you interpret that, oh, I didn't know my shoe was untied, or I could have used red as my sweatshirt and people stay more focused than blue, like, or the poster wasn't large enough and people couldn't read it from the back row because they couldn't see it, right? These are all things that, as you go through a process, they just help you refine your ideas and that feedback loop becomes much more helpful in the creative process. Yeah, so that's really where we've been focused in the last, I'd say, 5 years.
And you have a product or platform that does this?
Helio, it's connected to about 800,000 people, and you can find audiences, everything from people who buy certain things to people who are creative professionals to mailmen to basically any organized group of people. You can start to find sort of common behaviors that you can start to overlap. So you might be in a B2B company selling to people, and we have professionals that are able to give feedback. And it's different than say like usertesting.com, where you're trying to get pure usability feedback. This is more about micro moments and micro feedback in larger quantities. So the goal is to say, hey, if I had 100 people looking at this, what kind of feedback could I get and continue to use that audience over time? So when I think about, like, say, running a business or trying to operate something that's fairly complex, let's just take like a bagel shop. If you looked at the bagel shop and tried to interpret what's going on say like Monday, fresh bagels come in at 10. There's a wave of people that come at 10:30. The coffee might have brewed for 2 hours and that nobody comes for lunch because everyone's busy trying to get their Monday started. Tuesday operates completely different. And so you can start to see working with an audience over time is look at different patterns and behaviors of people as they're sort of using something over a longer period of time, not trying to like ask them a bunch of questions in this sort of microcosm of time, but over an extended period of time and keep asking them questions about the things you're working on. And you get these unique perspectives that sort of help you shape and come up with bigger ideas, because you can start to then change like the way you think about your business or the way you're building something creative. Because if you realize that, oh, no one's coming in on Monday, maybe just shut the shop down and don't do it until noon to try and get the noon people coming in. These are all things business owners are used to seeing because they're at a local level, see their audiences and try to make sense of the patterns. I find when people sort of abstract themselves and don't have maybe as much customer interactions, they start to lose these perspectives of sort of what is happening with their products and services. And so this is a unique opportunity to get closer to a group of people that would be pretty difficult to get to if you didn't have an organized way of keeping lists and being able to get that feedback from your customers.
That's super cool. I feel like we should use this on our new product that we launched, you know, like actually really interesting.
For creative services, I found that you can create a lift of about 30% in revenue just by doing this, because the need is there and being able to supplement services by trying to target, you know, that specific feedback that a customer might be looking for. It's a different process though, because it does open you up to like, why is this wrong? Why did you not do a good job, right? But if you incorporate that into the process and realize that the creative cycle is a little chaotic, as long as they see a point A and a point B and you're helping them get there, then being, I think, more open about why something works or doesn't work is a better creative process, because nothing is 100% right. You have to alienate or offend some people to get to the target group that you want to get to that are going to be your ravaged, super excited customers. And so understanding that helps you shape, you know, products with perhaps some of the negative feedback that might come in your decision-making. And that's a healthy thing though.
Yeah, that is healthy. And it's important to have that kind of open mindset and realize that like, it's part of finding product market fit is like getting feedback and seeing like, is this actually going to work? Do people want to buy this? Or do I just think it's a great idea? So cool that y'all have a solution for that.
My first job, I was a toy inventor. And what I learned in that job was we didn't actually make the toys. What we did was we sold ideas to toy companies that were looking to try and figure out what the next great hit was. And I learned a lot about how people, when you present ideas, what are they thinking about and what are they looking for and why do they buy things and what are they... I also learned a lot about like how consumers think about the products and services. So when you look at, say, trying to sell an idea, you have to understand the buyer has an idea of what they want in their head, but they also have this window of like possibilities where they don't really want the thing that's in their head. They want the thing outside of what's in their head, but then they have these constraints like 37 cents of plastic. I have the middle aisle at Target. Like I have to fit this sort of business problem. And so you realize that there's both these like hard constraints and the way that the business needs to operate. And then there's these other areas where people want to be in that space. That's like, I want this great idea. I want this thing, right? But they have a very hard time bridging those gaps. And so what I often feel creatives lack or need to be able to provide is the leap, the gap between the rational set of things that need to happen in this place of creating something magical and fun and exciting, which everyone wants, but is very like unwilling to just accept and have trust to get to and want to do. And I learned that very early on. So I realized that whatever I produced and tried to create, I need to start with the idea that it's irrational. Like it's not a rational set of things. Like, and if I wanted to, because I'm hyper-rational, if I wanted to try and tell you the utility of this thing is exactly what it needs to be, and I realized like people would not accept it because it's not how people buy things or accept things or want things or need things or and you have to figure out what those things are. And so I learned that very early on in the, you know, selling toys. It, strangely enough, before moving into to doing digital creative.
Yeah, cool. It's funny. It makes me think there's this popper toys out on the market now that kids just like love. And it's a fidget toy. Are you familiar with these? And you pop them like you, it's like they come in all different shapes and they're just, all it is rubber. And it's like you pop it from one side to the other, kind of like bubble wrap or something. And when I first saw this with my daughter, I was like, why is this so interesting? To me, it's not rational. They love it. They're like, just pop it. I'm like, okay.
People like repetition. They enjoy repetition. And they enjoy building on top of whatever that repetition is to make something uniquely theirs. Whether it's they've got a certain way they fidget it or creatively can talk to someone else. And the reason for that is because we enjoy having common bond with people in a way that we can both understand, but we also like to put some of our uniqueness onto things. And so things that are simple and pleasurable like that, there can be a simple shared bond that allows groups of people to kind of have fun together or even relate to each other or talk to each other. A fascinating part about the toy industry, and this one's pretty important, I think, for businesses that are trying to figure out, like, how do they get feedback from people? And this is a unique story, but it helps you understand that maybe it's not as difficult as you might think. So when we would create a new toy, we would invite kids to test these toys. And so we'd want to get their feedback because we're trying to figure out, how is this fun? Where are the problems? What do they think of it? What are they trying to do with it? You could probably think of it as like a focus group, but it did have utility and people. We would struggle to get maybe 50% of people showing up, oftentimes like 30%. And it was really just not fun because you're trying to sit there and trying to learn, but then people, I can't show up or whatever. So strangely enough, when we started charging people to show up, 90% plus of people started showing up to give us feedback. And I tell this story because most people are like, I don't know how to get feedback from my customers. Like, it's this mystery. And here we are charging people to come give us feedback on these toys that we were working on. And it had a better performance than just trying to get people, because we thought toys would be fun. Kids would want to come in. But when you charge, what it switched from was the kid, maybe this would be fun for my kid, to now I'm a parent and responsible for making sure my kid has an educational growth opportunity to test a toy. And parents then, by paying for it, had a more invested sort of like mindset going into it, and they're more willing to show up. So what I learned in this process, and what I think businesses and individuals can think about, is if people are willing to pay to give you feedback, there's a way to get it, right? There's a way for you to find pathways to your customers to be able to have conversations about the things you're making and the things that you're producing in a way that maybe is unsurprising to you. But you have to be somewhat creative in that process and willing to figure it out. Fascinating the way psychology works when trying to figure out how people buy your products and use your products and give you feedback on products.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I love that. I think about that often in the realm of branding and how to, you know, like get people's attention and like really hitting at a deep psychological, you know, level. So it's really interesting to be able to talk to you because that's something on my mind a lot. And you're taking it into the actual like building of products, and very cool. Well, let's finish up with one question for you, Brian.
Uh-oh, that sounds ominous.
Yeah, I know. We really tee it up here, you know, just like, if you weren't nervous during this whole conversation, you'll be nervous now. No, I'm kidding. What's the best compliment you've ever gotten?
You know, the strange thing about the nature of our work is that the expectation that people give you some sort of feedback or whatnot, I've learned to accept that when something just works or something is magical, that you can see that in their use of it. And so there isn't necessarily a direct response to what I've produced. you just see people talking about or being able to. And that to me is like the best compliment, because we've done all the work, we've done all the persuasion, and you just see people engaged in having fun or getting the benefits out of something. So I know that's maybe a punt answer, but I feel like that to me and my team, it's not about trying to make a customer happy, like a customer that I might be serving. It's their customer or their end users that get the benefit out of it. And that's when you know you have success. And that's when you know you've done a good job and you've really helped a company. So I tend to keep my ears open and eyes looking to the things that we've produced to be able to really feel satisfied and a deeper connection to, you know, what we're working on. There's no usual direct feedback there. So it's more of watching and seeing them use something.
Yeah, I love that. I feel you on that one. That's a great compliment. We appreciate your time. I've enjoyed this conversation thoroughly and hope to have you back sometime. Maybe we'll come up with another topic, because this was really, really good. And I'd love to stay connected over the course of the year and laugh about what other failures we all have along the way.
Well, hey there. That was fun. I love how much mind-blowing and mind-opening shizzle our guests bring to us with every episode. We hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did. Make sure you hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast player so that you don't miss a beat of the Talking Shizzle podcast. And if you're listening on Apple, be sure to let us know what you thought and leave us a review. We'd love to hear from our listeners so that we can bring you all the good, juicy business growth shizzle that you would like to hear about. Get in touch with us and follow along at creativeshizzle.com or email us at podcast@creativeshizzle.com. Until next time, keep making your shizzle happen.